And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. We're streaming online for you. Want to have you gather up a pencil and paper, because it's a good thing to be able to write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, all that information that you'll need in order to take action. Starting with action, let's start with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter of the Habitat Restoration Team, will have a habitat restoration this Saturday, September 24th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Sand Hill Bluff in the Wilder Ranch State Park. Thousands of years ago, California Indians moved into an area just north of Santa Cruz, hunting tule elk, deer, bear, and shoreline fur seals. The ancestral Ohlone people gathered and stayed in this area called Sand Hill Bluff. When Sand Hill Bluff is eventually open to the public, visitors will be able to visit the impressive and ancient archaeological site left by the Ohlone. The preservation of this area opens the door for research into the past residents of this part of the California coast. According to State Parks archaeologist Mark Hilkema, Sand Hill Bluff is an outstanding archaeological site with a history that goes back almost 5,700 years. Our focus this Saturday will be the removal of invasive non-native ice plant on the island inland side of the coastal bluffs. We hope to see you out there. Due to parking constraints and the number of folks anticipated at the project site, we will meet at Wilder Ranch State Park and carpool to the site. So please try to arrive by 9:50 in the morning. We will plan on leaving and heading to the project site by 10 a.m. How to get to Wilder Ranch? Well, take Highway 1 west through Santa Cruz and head north until you see the Wilder Ranch turn off on the left-hand side. At the kiosk, let the person know you're there to be a volunteer, and they'll give you a parking pass. Meet us at the interpretive sign by the bathrooms in the parking lot. And once again, do be there by 9:50 so that they can get on the road by 10 a.m. The Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitat in parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It'll probably be shine this weekend, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring your gloves and water. For questions, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. Email to redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net, or you can visit the webpage at www.cruisecnps.org. And once again, that restoration this Saturday, September 24th, meet 9:50 at the Wilder Ranch State Park. And in news from Klamath Siskiyou Wild, the historic Wrangell Camp Meadow has been protected through a collaborative fencing project. Over the past few years, extreme off-road vehicle uses have carved illegal off-road trails through this botanically rich High Siskiyou Meadow. This unique wildflower habitat, known for pollinators and a spring important to hikers on the Pacific Crest Trail, is also a special historic site. Several picnic tables and a rustic shelter were built by the Civilian Conservation Corps in 1936. There is also a cabin built by the Soil Conservation Service in the 1930s. Thanks to the work of the Northwest Youth Corps, the North National Forest Service, and Klamath Siskiyou Wild, this one-of-a-kind place is now protected by a rustic wooden fence to keep off-road vehicles out. And a grazing allotment buyout protects drinking water and biodiversity at the Oregon Caves National Monument. Earlier this year, Klamath Siskiyou Wild organized a grazing allotment buyout with a local rancher in the Siskiyou Mountains within and surrounding the Oregon Caves National Monument. The buyout will forever protect the high-elevation meadows around Grayback Mountain Botanical Area, Miller Lake Research Natural Area, and the Magic Bigelow Lakes area. More than 80,000 visitors a year to Oregon Caves get their drinking water from sources that originate in the Bigelow Lakes Basin. Public forests and alpine meadows formerly damaged by cattle are now cattle-free. Over 30,000 acres of high-elevation Siskiyou wildlands are protected through this expansion and allotment retirement. And civilian response makes a difference. The Bureau of Land Management has backed off regenerating harvests in the Jigsaw timber sale. It took nearly 1,800 letters from concerned citizens like you, but it worked. The BLM recently released a decision in part for the Jigsaw timber sale area in which they reversed course and selected a forest thinning alternative instead of a proposed clear cutting. While the resulting forest thinning is not perfect, at least there will be still a forest there, where before the BLM had hoped to leave nothing but stumps. Predictably, some in the timber industry are hopping mad at the BLM for choosing thinning over clear-cutting. Glamis Siskiyou Wild will keep a close eye on both the BLM logging and the timber industry pressure on to clear-cut lands. And together, we're making a lasting difference for our forests. If you want more information, go to www.kswild.org. And this announcement from in Oregon, the Ned's Bar timber sale in the Applegate Valley has been tree spiked. That's NEDSBAR timber sale in the Applegate Valley has been tree spiked in this story submitted to the Earth First Newswire. The Ned's Bar timber sale in the southern Oregon Applegate Valley has been tree spiked. The BLM's decision to go forward with this project is unacceptable. Any company who bids on the logging of these trees should also consider itself a possible target of sabotage. For those opposed to the Ned's Bar timber sale, we would like to remind you that known green scare snitch Suzanne Savoy and her almost equally untrustworthy partner Luke Rudiger are active in groups opposing Ned's Bar. Anyone serious about challenging the current state of ecological devastation would be wise to exclude them from their lives, and especially environmental organizing. Rather than begging for concessions from or trying to use the institutions that perpetuate the current state of affairs, how about working in small leaderless groups and taking direct action in any way you see fit? Signed, some anarchists. And, of course, we found that at theearthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And resistance is heating up in British Columbia on Mount Elphinstone in this story from BC Blackout, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Loggers arriving at cut block A87125 in the forest above Roberts Creek on Monday morning were greeted by a flaming log blockade across the access road. The fiery obstacle is the latest salvo in a confrontation that has been simmering since Peninsula Logging won a British Columbia timber sales auction for the 18-hectare mixed forest earlier this year. "We thought there was going to be protester presence here, but we didn't expect this," said Aaron Service, co-owner of Peninsula Logging. "Every time they pull something like this, it costs the crew about 2 hours of work." Several groups of protesters have been camping out in the woods near the cut block over the summer, watching for activity on the site. But with logging now in full swing, the opposition has escalated to protest rallies, road blockades, and arrests. "Some protesters have entered the work site. It's extremely dangerous," Service said of the incursions. "We don't want to see anyone get killed." That's nice sentiment. Over the past 2 weeks, 9 people have been arrested from the Forest Service road leading to the site for violating a Supreme Court injunction, according to Sheckelt RCMP spokesperson Harrison Moore. Peninsula obtained a temporary injunction to stop protesters from interfering with logging activity late in August. Attempts by the protest group Elphinstone Logging Focus to lift the injunction were unsuccessful. "We have a real problem with the way they obtained their injunction. It was an underhanded process," said Ross Muirhead, founder of ELF. That's Elphinstone Logging Focus. They went for a judge in Vernon, and because it was ex-party, a single-party decision, they didn't even notify us, so we couldn't make a submission. The Elphinstone Logging Focus took no responsibility for Monday's fiery blockade, though the group has participated in several protests and blockades. When protesters blockaded the road Friday, the RCMP came to enforce the injunction. One woman who calls herself Salamander attached herself to a piece of heavy equipment by the neck with a bicycle lock. "I care about the natural world, and this is an endangered ecosystem," she said. "There aren't many places like this in the world." A complaint lodged by ELF to the Forest Practices Board contends that the worksite and the area surrounding should be protected as a vulnerable blue-listed ecosystem with characteristics similar to the Great Bear Rainforest. "That investigation may take months to complete," said Muirhead. Logging opponents claim the cut block is in an area of emerging old growth, an old growth forest that was raised by fire about 150 years ago but never logged. Many of the older trees still standing show scars from that fire. The cut block also falls within the boundaries of a 1,500-hectare expansion of Mount Elphinstone Provincial Park proposed by the official community plan for Roberts Creek. The park is divided into 3 widely separated parcels totaling 139 hectares. The park as it exists today is divided into three tiny ecological islands. We would like to see a contiguous park in place, said Muirhead. We hope this protest raises the profile of the park expansion campaign and makes it very clear that British Columbia timber sales that cut block sales within the park expansion area are unwelcome. All the protesters have been released with a promise to appear in Supreme Court in Vancouver September 26th because the court process relates to contempt of court rather than a criminal code offense. There are no criminal charges, and Sunshine Coast RCMP is not able to release the names of the persons arrested, said Moore. Peninsula will pay about $1.3 million to the provincial government for the right to harvest fir, cedar, and hemlock, much of it for utility poles and lumber to be processed by Teal Jones and Coastland Wood Industries in British Columbia. Story found in the Earth First Newswire. And moving to the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field, the fate of 49 Yellowstone bison are awaiting a quarantine decision. 6 months after being captured inside Yellowstone National Park, 49 young buffalo are still confined inside the park's Stevens Creek bison trap. These once wild bison were part of a group of 57 calves captured by the Park Service in February. In May and June, 8 of those bison were sent to slaughter after brucellosis antibodies were detected in their blood. The presence of antibodies, which condemn these young bison to slaughter, only indicates exposure to the livestock disease and not an actual infection. Buffalo quarantine tears bison calves away from their family groups, confines them to fenced pastures where they are fed hay, and subjects them to invasive livestock management practices for 2 to 4 years. Approximately half of all quarantined buffalo are slaughtered during the process, and any survivors are loaded into livestock trailers and transported to fenced pastures where they live out the remainder of their lives like domestic cows. Yellowstone officials recently told the Buffalo Field Campaign that the next mention of the captive buffalo will include a press release, something we interpret to mean that a decision on operational quarantine may be coming soon. And you can find out this and more information at the newly redesigned Buffalo Field Campaign website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And indigenous communities are mobilizing to defend Guatemala's forests from loggers in this story by Jeff Abbott of Waging Violence, as found in the Earth First Newswire. And this is an edited version. Across Guatemala, indigenous communities are organizing to challenge logging in the country's vast forests. These communities are concerned with the impact that both legal and illegal logging will have on their watersheds and on the environment. On June 15th, concerned residents from the Highland Ixalmaya municipality of Nabaj, Quiche, staged a protest outside the municipal building to express their concern with the steady increase in trucks leaving town loaded with lumber. The action was organized by residents and members of the Indigenous Authority of Nabaj in order to pressure the state authorities to strip 9 companies of their licenses to exploit timber on private lands. Residents raised concern over the fact that the deforestation affects everyone in the area. Following the protest, concerned residents of the neighborhood Ixal municipality of Cajul blocked and detained several trucks transporting timber from that region for a number of hours. They demanded that the National Institute of Forests, or INAB, and the Division for the Protection of the Environment cease their operations and describe the amount of lumber being taken from local forests as excessive. The indigenous authorities of Nabaj also issued a statement to INAB asking them to take action, but the government body declined to act and issued a statement that they are planting new trees for every one that is cut down. But this response did not satisfy concerned residents. We went to the government bodies and issued statements asking to cease extending licenses for the exploitation of forests, said Katie Terrazas, the communications representative for the indigenous authorities of Nabaj. They told us they were sowing new trees, but how long will it take for those trees to grow to the same size as the trees that were there before? The companies involved in logging operations responded to the protest by significantly reducing the number of trucks transporting lumber from the mountains. According to residents, however, it is unclear if this will continue into the future. The mobilization of communities organizing to challenge logging operations in the highlands of Guatemala represent a growing concern over the destruction of the environment by private companies. This challenge to logging companies reflects the understanding of communities that the vital part forests play in the protection of water sources. The trees serve us and the animals, Terraza said. The loss of trees is drying up aquifers. As a youth and a human, I must think of my future and what I'm leaving my children. Other communities held similar protests following the actions taken in the Ixil region. On June 26th, a similar action was held in Santa Cruz del Quiche, the department's largest city. Once again, protesters were demanding the authorities stop issuing licenses for the exploitation of forests. I guess that's Quiche. Yeah, it would be Quiche in French, but anyway, Guatemala is home to vast forests and jungles, but these regions have increasingly come under threat due to deforestation. Critics blame uneducated campesinos clearing land for agriculture as one of the prime culprits. This does represent a threat, but there are bigger threats, including lumber companies and organized crime. The protest over the logging industry activity in indigenous regions occurs at a time in Guatemala of increased concerns over deforestation and comes after the historic March for Water in April of 2016. Community representatives, non-governmental organizations, and activists see a connection between forests and water. The Guatemalan government, too, maintains a campaign of reforestation, but this has not stopped companies from cutting down forests for the valuable woods or the raising of forests by narco-traffickers in the northern department of Petén to build landing strips. The same land fund that assisted us in purchasing our land was pressuring us to sell the forests in order to resolve the debt, said Veronica Hernandez, a 47-year-old community leader. But we refused because we would have sold our forests. We would have been left without water or with contaminated water. And this was found in the Earth First Journal's Newswire. And Sea Shepherd Turtle Defense Campaign has been ordered to stop by the Costa Rican government in this story from the Costa Rican Times, as found on the Earth First Newswire. The Costa Rican government is forcing Sea Shepherd to shut down Operation Juaro 2, a campaign to protect endangered sea turtles. Any Sea Shepherd volunteer found patrolling beaches or engaging in sea turtle conservation work will be detained and deported. In Costa Rica, the Jaco police teamed with Sea Shepherd on the campaign to protect nesting females and nests from poachers. The nests were being relocated to a hatchery run by the Jaco police force. Sea Shepherd was informed on Friday that the Jaco police is no longer authorized to work with the nonprofit organization. Captain Osvaldo Rodriguez, chief of the Garabito Police Department in Jaco, was ordered not to work with Sea Shepherd because they are, quote, known criminals, unquote. Presumably, the criminal reference stems from the red notice issued by Interpol on Sea Shepherd founder Captain Paul Watson back in 2012 for the Costa Rican charge of interfering with a Costa Rican shark finning operation. This is a very difficult moment for us volunteers here in Costa Rica, said Operation Juaro 2 ground leader Christina Selly. In less than 2 weeks, we have saved almost 2,000 eggs from the beaches of Hermosa, Claritas, and Jaco that most likely would have been poached, and 63 very disoriented hatchlings that didn't stand a chance to survive if we weren't there. Our presence has made a difference for these eggs and hatchlings, but now, thanks to mediocre minds, we have to stop, and the only ones who have anything or everything to lose are the turtles, added Chief Operating Officer David Hance. I'm disgusted with the government of Costa Rica is willing to sacrifice the lives of thousands of turtles simply because they are motivated by international politics. No good conservation deed goes unpunished in Costa Rica, noted Sea Shepherd President and CEO Paul Watson. If you stop shark finning or rescue baby turtles, you are considered a criminal by the Costa Rican government. Costa Rica is a country where rescuing turtles can literally get you killed. This government can always be dependent upon to side with the poachers. And Norway is planning to cull more than two-thirds of its wolf population in this story by Fiona Harvey of The Guardian, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Norway is planning to cull more than two-thirds of its remaining wolves in a step that environmental groups say will be disastrous for the dwindling numbers of the species in the wild. There are an estimated about 68 wolves remaining in the wilderness areas of Norway, concentrated in the southeast of the country. But under controversial plans approved last Friday, as many 47 of these will be shot. Hunting is a popular sport in Norway. Last year, more than 11,000 hunters applied for licenses to shoot 16 wolves, a ratio of more than 700 applicants for every license issued. The government has justified this year's planned cull, the biggest in more than a century, on the basis of harm done to sheep flocks by the predators. Environmental groups dispute this, saying the real damage is minimal and the response all out of proportion. The Norwegian government did not reply to a request from the Guardian for comment. The government has taken action to prevent illegal wolf killing. Wolves are also an attraction for some tourists to the country, but the new legal hunting limit is beyond anything that the wild population can withstand, according to Norway's leading green groups. Under the arrangements, 24 wolves will be shot within a region of the country designated for wolf habitat, while another 13 will be shot in neighboring regions and another 10 in other areas of the country. According to environmental groups, the number of wolves the government plans to kill this year is greater than in any year since 1911. Nina Jensen, chief executive of the World Wildlife Fund in Norway, said, "This is mass slaughter. We have not seen anything like this in 100 years, back when the policy was that all large carnivores were to be eradicated. Shooting 70% of the wolf population is not worthy of a nation claiming to be championing environmental causes. People all over the country and outside its borders are now reacting." She said losses to farmers from wolves had been minimal and pointed to settlements by the Norwegian Parliament in 2004 and 2011 that stipulated populations of carnivores must be allowed to coexist with livestock. "This decision must be stopped," said Silje Ask Lundberg, chair of Friends of the Earth Norway. "With this decision, 3 out of 6 family groups of wolves might be shot. We are calling on the Minister of Environment to stop the butchering today. Norway should be ashamed." And rare rescued trout are returning to McLeod River tributaries in this story from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Northern Region Inland Fisheries Program and Heritage and Wild Trout Program staff will soon reintroduce a small population of rare rescued trout to their native waters in the McLeod River in Shasta County, California. McLeod River red band trout is one of several sensitive and unique fish species that has required human intervention in order to ensure their survival during California's enduring drought. The drought continues to be devastating on the populations of these important fish, said Andrew Jensen, a biologist with California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Northern Region Inland Fisheries Program. "If we did not take action to save them during the summers, small independent populations may have succumbed. Our proactive rescue efforts will help maintain this unique species for the future." CDFW biologists monitoring McLeod Red Band streams, which are tributaries in the upper McLeod River from late 2013 to mid-2015, found that drought effects were causing perilous conditions for the fish in both winter, with sections of the streams freezing over, and in summer, when sections of the streams were going dry. McLeod Red Band, a state-listed species of special concern, are in no immediate risk of extinction, but their populations are small, fragmented, and exist only in a few small streams. Rescue operations by CDFW in 2013-15 greatly reduced the drought mortality of the species. Anticipating potential drought impacts on sensitive wild fish populations, CDFW installed self-contained recirculating aquaculture systems, or RAS, at several CDFW hatcheries throughout the state last year. The RAS enabled the hatcheries to safely house rescued wild fish until environmental conditions improve. One of these facilities, CDFW's Mount Shasta Hatchery, was selected to serve as a drought-safe haven for the McLeod Red Band due to its proximity to the imperiled streams. More than 1,000 McLeod Red Band were brought to the facility, where many were spawned by CDFW staff. Today, much of California remains in a drought, but the upper McLeod River watershed received some relief in the first half of 2016 with near-normal precipitation during the winter and spring. CDFW fisheries biologists believe that these improved habitat conditions and forecasted conditions will support the release of the rescued McLeod Red Band trout. Both the rescued adult fish and the hatchery origin juveniles will be released beginning this week in sections of the stream that will provide the best chance of long-term success with minimal impacts to the existing natural origin populations. All the released fish will be tagged, allowing fisheries biologists to track their movement and survival after release in the river. And you can get more information at www.wildlife.ca.gov. And a sea otter survey is encouraging, but comes up short of the perfect story. The southern sea otter continues its climb toward recovery, according to the annual count released by the U.S. Geological Survey and their partners today. For the first time, southern sea otter's numbers have exceeded the threshold required by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to consider delisting the species as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The annual count will need to surpass this threshold for the next 2 years for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to review the otter's listed status. However, localized population declines at the northern and southern ends of the range continue to be a cause for concern among resource management officials. This year's survey results suggest an increasing trend over the past 5 years of more than 3% per year. The population index, a statistical representation of the entire population calculated as the 3-year running average of census counts, has climbed to 3,272, up from 2,939 in 2013. The growth is accounted for by an unexpected jump in numbers in the center of the sea otters range, an area that spans the California coast from Monterey south to Cambria. We believe the high count this year is partly explained by excellent viewing conditions, but it also appears to reflect increased food availability in the range center, says Dr. Tim Tinker, a research ecologist who leads the USGS Sea Otter Research Program. The boom in sea urchin abundance throughout the northern and central California has provided a prey bonanza for sea otters, and that means more pups and juveniles were surviving to adulthood. While the overall population index continues to trend upward, the northern and southern subsets of the population continue a negative 5-year decline, dropping 2.5% and 0.6% respectively per year. We are still seeing large numbers of stranded otters near the range peripheries, a high percentage of which have lethal shark bite wounds, said Mike Harris, a biologist with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. These deaths may explain the lack of population growth in those areas. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 p.m. right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, live on 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast, tune into Free Radio tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. If you're in North Adams, Massachusetts, tune in to WMNB 107.1 on Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. In Moscow, Idaho, tune in to KRFP 90.3 FM Wednesday afternoons at 3 p.m. Or in Dade City, Florida, tune in to WLSL 92.7 FM Sundays at noon. You can also search out Grateful Dread Public Radio at gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 in the morning. And you can also find them at Spotify and TuneIn.com. Or you can always go to radioforall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous versions of the Earth First Update. That's radio, the number, for all.net. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It's free to download and air. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio, produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening. And unfortunately, you're going to have to wait a few weeks for the next Earth First Update, as I will be out fishing. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.